Tapeheads is a production of the NFL in partnership with iHeartRadio. Welcome to another week of Tapeheads. The playoffs underway. The divisional matchups are set. It was super wild card weekend in name only. It wasn't so super. Bob Wischusen here with Dan Orlovsky and Scott Pioli. Again, we try to crawl behind the X's and O's here on Tapeheads, give you the inside football, and we can really dive deep now that we've got less games to talk about, the best teams in the National Football League playing each other. But this past weekend, guys, we were thinking we were going to get some epic matchups that turned into absolute drubbings. And I think we probably have to start with the one that really kind of kicked the whole thing off in terms of the drubbings that were, you know, nationally focused upon all week. We were waiting for Saturday night and that Bills-Patriots matchup. And this turned into about as big an embarrassment, I would say, for an offense to a defense as we've ever seen in the postseason. It was the perfect game. The Bills scored a touchdown every single time they had the football in that game, as opposed to kneeling down at the end of the first half and the end of the game. If they were on offense trying to score, they scored a touchdown. I've never seen anything like it, considering the fact that it's a defense we talked about being a good defense all year, a Bill Belichick coached defense. I mean, Dan, start it with you. How stunned were you? Not that the Bills won the game, but the way that they won it, dominating physically, and every time they wanted to go down the field, no matter which way, shape, or form they did it, to put seven on the board.
Yeah, I think, Bob, for you to say you've never seen anything like is hyperbolic. You're a Jets fan.
That's
you've
not nice.
Probably seen it twice a
nice.
Season, man.
Is that
not
how
nice.
We're going to start this thing? Wow.
I mean, geez. Jeez, you know, here's the thing.
Never miss an opportunity to take your shot, bud.
I am supposed to have been able to enjoy the Patriots getting drubbed on Saturday night, and you actually flipped it around and sucked the life out of my enjoyment by turning it into a Jets joke. That's not nice.
Who needs friends when you've got me?
Terrible way to start.
So I think the most impressive thing for that game was, for me, was Josh Allen and the Buffalo Bills offense beat New England when New England was doing their bread and butter stuff defensively, when New England was doing their simulated pressures or was dropping guys out and being physical at the line of scrimmage and hitting receivers mid-route while also keeping vision on the quarterback when he moved. There's so many plays in the game that stand out to me because when Josh Allen is used in this capacity where he's weaponized by Brian Daboll, their offensive coordinator, he's almost indefensible. You know, I called him Shohei Ohtani, so to speak. There's not a single thing he can't do. And when he's used like that, it's really difficult. So remember early on in the football game, Buffalo gets the ball and Josh has that really long 27-yard scramble on second down or something like that. Yeah. That's one of those plays for me, Scott, that is that bread and butter. I mean, New England is playing man coverage. They rotate coverage at the snap. Both defensive ends or outside linebackers, Judon and Van Noy, smash guys at the line of scrimmage getting off in their routes. While doing that, they're doing a rush to force Josh Allen out a certain way. He does. Judon is there waiting. So as a on-paper play call, you're going, this is exactly what we want. But then Josh went into, I'm a better athlete than you type of playmaking mode. That's also the touchdown pass to Dawson Knox that he has when he's really kind of throwing that ball away. It's the same exact thing. So I'm watching this game going, Josh is not only not being hurt by the stuff that New England is doing, but he's hurting them doing some of their best stuff. And I think that was in the moment in the game for me, Bob and Scott, where I was just like, New England's in trouble with the way that Buffalo's operating. Then Buffalo, you know, their RPO game was just so good. And getting guys running away from man coverage, some of the crossing routes that he threw were just so good. So it is a tip of the cap to Brian Daboll and Josh Allen for the way that they went about the plan and then the execution.
I agree. You know, I did not see it coming the way it happened. Again, not surprised that Buffalo won. I thought it was going to be an evenly matched game, and it wasn't. And it wasn't from the beginning. And, you know, you're looking at a Patriots defense. I think they were ranked second in scoring coming into the game.
Correct.
And in a number of other places, they were ranked in the top five, top 10. And I said, okay, I think Josh Allen's getting hot, that the Buffalo Bills offense, their team's getting healthier, they're getting better at the right time. They're going to be a handful. And But again, I didn't expect to see what I saw. And, you know, Bob, I don't want to make too much fun. I'm going to take that beat down in a different direction. You know, I would love to find, this sounds crazy, but the 1940 championship film where the Bears beat Washington 73-0 to see if it was anything like, or to see the play-by-play, if they had play-by-play.
I got another joke, guys.
Oh,
but I'm
stop.
It's not nice.
What's been fascinating to me is we're seeing two teams at the end of the year trending in different directions. And it used to be for the Patriots for a long time. The Patriots, you know, and that was part of our mantra when I was there, was, hey, get strong, get stronger at the end of November, own December, and roll into January. And that was not the case this year. Where you look at Buffalo, and they are rolling right now. Everything they're doing is right. They did a great job in terms of playing clean football. No turnovers, penalties limited. They played smart, tough football. And, you know, Brian Daboll is getting a lot of credit, as he should. Josh Allen getting a lot of credit, as he should. Sean McDermott, I give him a ton of credit, because to me, the moment that changed their season was when they got beat at home earlier in the year.
They got hammered, sure.
And they got beat, but they got beat physically. And, you know, yeah. I went into this game, I was thinking, okay, the Patriots are going to line up, cold weather, extra linemen, use Jakob Johnson. Because prior to that, Jakob Johnson, that was in the earlier game in the snow and cold in Buffalo, that was his high watermark in terms of snaps. And I thought that's what the Patriots were going to line up and do. And they were going to play smash mouth football. I didn't think that they would be able to dominate like they did in the first game. I just thought, okay, they're all, both sides are going to leave it all out there. And I'll tell you what, Buffalo stepped up and smashed the Patriots in the mouth.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question, Scott and Bob? Obviously, you know, like your thought on this as well. So when I watched this game, something else that stood out to me was, you know, Buffalo lost one of the best corners in football.
Yeah.
And their coverage has not slipped at all. And it makes, if you watch, it's first quarter, 9:40. And if you watch, and then second quarter, 15 minutes, and then second quarter, 6:20. If you, like, Jordan Poyer and Micah Hyde are so good at everything on defense, both in the run and the pass. And those clips are how quickly those guys are triggering against the run. And when I say triggering, it's like the ball's getting handed off or just about to getting handed off, and they've already put their back foot in the ground to drive at the football. And it's there's so much key recognition that's going on. I think, like, for me, I've always thought, like, well, safeties. They're safeties, you know? I give me the lockdown corner, so to speak. And I think that those two players are so profoundly impactful on their defense in coverage and in the run support. Where are you with how the importance of a safety, so to speak, you know?
Dan, well, not just the importance of, I want to follow up on what you're saying. When you watch the tape and you watch them specifically, what I find fascinating is how they, I'm waiting, they don't get caught biting on the play action.
Right.
And to me, that's one of the biggest differences. Exactly what you're talking about. You're exactly right. So to me, they're doing something that is different than a lot of other safeties and or cover linebackers, where they're recognizing correctly. And I don't know if they're guessing. Yes. I don't think they're guessing, but they're certainly recognizing correctly, which is allowing them to be much more efficient, just like you're talking about, Dan.
And I think also there's a trickle-down effect from their defensive line, isn't there?
Yes.
Right? Like you can play those two safeties almost anywhere you want, in any way that you want. You can keep them both deep. You can trigger one up near the line of scrimmage, because how often did they have to get pressure on Mac Jones bringing numbers?
Right.
I mean, how often did they get to Mac Jones and at least get him off his spot, if not whack him, having to send extra people after him? Well, if you can do that, if I've got these pass rushers that can go get this quarterback and throw him off his game, now I've got these two incredibly versatile, dangerous safeties. I mean, now you can put them anywhere on the chessboard you want, right? Like, mm-hmm. how much mm-hmm. versatility must that give a defensive play caller?
It's huge. It's also, just speaking from an offensive perspective, it's huge. And Bob, also their linebackers. You know, Milano and Edmonds, and I'd say AJ Klein had a phenomenal game as well, but Milano and Edmonds are so, you know, when we often, in offensive football, it's how are you going to match up versus me? You know, when I'm an offensive play call, you know, how are you going to match up versus my tight end or my back? And I think those guys give that defense and Leslie Frazier, their D coordinator, such flexibility because you talked about the defensive line and their ability to play fast and then down the line of scrimmage and violent and physical, but also those linebackers can do everything as well. Those linebackers, you want to use them as blitzers, they can do that. You want them to be at the point of contact, they can do that. You want them, I mean, Milano running sideline to sideline, I think is in the conversation for as good as any linebacker in the NFL. It's running sideline to sideline specifically. So I just, we fall in love with Buffalo in regards to their offense, as we should, but I was just so impressed with so many aspects of their defense.
When I was watching the game, you know, I thought because of the cold weather that special teams was going to be really important. And as I was waiting for something to happen on special teams, the first couple of special teams play I saw this difference in speed and energy and violence by the Buffalo Bills on special teams where I said to myself, I said, uh-oh, something is different today. And to me, part of it was the exposure of the team speed that Buffalo had, but also the urgency in which they were playing on special teams.
And this stretch run is going to be a learning experience for Mac Jones, is right? I mean, like during the season, we probably gave him too much credit for how they were playing. And obviously the quarterback always becomes the focus. They lose four out of their last five games. The win they had before losing four out of their last five, he threw three passes in the game. That was the game at Buffalo. So you almost have to go back to Thanksgiving, the last time that Mac Jones had an impactful game against a good team. They beat Jacksonville, and he threw three touchdowns against them. Other than that, you know, the last month of the season, I think what we have to now, like, project forward with Mac Jones is, can he get to where these other quarterbacks are in year two, three, and four, like Josh Allen, like Joe Burrow, because that probably is where we have to shift our focus next, and that is the win by the Cincinnati Bengals as they end a three-decade playoff drought with Joe Burrow and the Bengals moving on to the divisional round. Here's what he had to quickly say after their win, the historic nature of it.
It's exciting, but we have a great team and great coaching staff. And like I said, we're on to the next week. It's going to be fun tomorrow to watch the games, knowing we have the win. You know, I was glad we were the first game so we could get it out of the way and watch these games and watch the film tomorrow and get back to work.
Guys, this is an exciting team, right? An exciting quarterback, an exciting team. They've got all the weapons necessary. He keeps on winning in spite of the fact that we wonder about the protection in front of him. And, you know, this Bengals team, you wonder, can they keep this rolling?
I love the Bengals. I think everybody that's ever heard me speak this year knows I love the Bengals. I love Burrow and I love their weapons. Listen, about this game, I'd say number one, when you sit in cover three all game and continuously get attacked in cover three all game, the offense is going to have some success. So, and that's a little bit of, I thought the Raiders were very vanilla, and they have been, but very vanilla, and they kept getting attacked in different ways against their cover three. The big thing that I liked out of Cincinnati or I was impressed with out of Cincinnati is Joe is doing such a good job of getting himself out of muddy situations while also playing on time. And that's a rarity to have both of those happen at the same time. That he has, I said this yesterday, who, what, where, when, why, how. He's doing such a phenomenal job of that when it comes to playing quarterback. Like who on the defense am I reading? What kind of throw is necessary in this moment? Why am I throwing the football to this guy? When? The timing of it? Where? Where does the ball have to be placed? You know, and how? What kind of tempo or trajectory? So he's just doing a really good job feel-wise with that. And Cincinnati obviously has a massive challenge coming up this week against Tennessee. But the way that Joe is playing when it comes to the efficiency of their offense is going to challenge Tennessee's defense.
I've got to say the thing that surprised me in a really good way, and I'm thankful for it, that we got to see this year in terms of Joe Burrow, was his ability to come back from the injury. That was a bad injury last year. And to come back and to not be gun shy, for a lack of a better term, and to be able to step up and do what he did and not allow last year's injury or last year's circumstance and situation to get in his head, because he's been back there slinging it all year. So right. I give him a ton of credit for his mental and emotional resiliency that he has shown. Again, yeah, the talent's there. We all know how talented he is. But again, the mental and emotional part is what stands out to me and what Joe Burrow's done this year.
Well, another team that's got immense talent and again turns into an immense disappointment, the Dallas Cowboys. We're going to talk about them when we come back. What did Sunday tell us about the issues that Dallas will be facing now and in the future? That's next on Tape Heads. Welcome back to Tape Heads. All right, look, I don't care about the Dallas Cowboys. I'm not a fan of the Dallas Cowboys. It's not like I spend my nights thinking about the Dallas Cowboys. And yet I was infuriated. Like, I was awake on the other night thinking about the Dallas Cowboys. Why? Well, probably because of the way the game ended and probably because of after you run a quarterback draw up the middle with 14 seconds to go and not get another snap off and lose the game the way that they did, that afterwards their head coach would double down on the decision.
Could you weigh the risk of having Dak run the ball in the middle of the field? And
weigh the risk? No, I have no problem with the call. We call the situation a church, you know, church clock situation. This is something we practice every Friday and Saturday. So, you know, we're trying to get inside the 20-yard line. We want the last play to come down to, you know, it would have been some form of five vertical pass concept. So we had two set, you know, based on which, you know, where we were going to be, you know, in the final yardage here. So, yeah. Based on, you know, being that tight, 14 seconds, we should clearly get the ball spiked there. And you know, I haven't seen the replay. I'm sure you have, but I'm surprised. I was shocked as anybody on offense that we didn't get to that last play.
All right, guys, you guys break the tape down. Let's break down the tape.
Huh.
Your thoughts, Scott Pioli? You want to kick it off Scott, I really want to see if I can inflict some pain on you and have you kick this off and talk about how that game ended. I've got a couple of questions for you guys, but I'd just like your initial thoughts.
Well, you know, in terms of the end of the game, I'll just say this. I think that there's multiple people that bear responsibility for that. Everyone wants to, the folks that want to blame the officials, I'll just say flat out, they're wrong.
Correct.
And I think to me, there's equal or some amount of blame. Gosh, I hate the word blame, but there's the responsibility.
I love it.
With the, I know you do, Dan. There's responsibility with not only the head coach, but the offensive coordinator and the quarterback. And I've been in situations like this. And there's checks and balances for a reason, right? A veteran, smart quarterback is the one that's executing. They know what they have to do, what they don't have to do. The play caller needs to know not only the play, call the play, but make sure that they let the quarterback know they have helmet microphones for a reason or speakers. And, you know, the head coach has responsibility. When I saw this play unfold, again, I think here's what I don't like about this is people are pointing the finger at one of those three people too much. All of them bear some responsibility or burden of responsibility in that play and the way it unfolded, in my opinion.
Yeah, so the final play comes down to this. I believe that Mike McCarthy is ultimately responsible for how everything goes down. You're the head coach. You should, the way things get operated always falls under your jurisdiction, I guess, is there. I'm probably using the incorrect word, but it falls under your oversight. I have actually been in an NFL game in the very same situation, except field goal was needed. 14 seconds were on the clock. I was with the Houston Texans. We were on the road against the Indianapolis Colts. 14 seconds were on the clock. We got in the same formation, empty, five offensive linemen. And our goal was to get five more yards, get up and spike the ball. So we got an empty. Owen Daniels ran a five-yard stick route or a five-yard out route. Matt Schaub caught it, threw it to him. Owen Daniels went down right to the ground. So the first process is 14 seconds is like the I'm near-death experience. I can't get right. any. You want 16 seconds
Correct.
For comfort like operation-wise?
Every single thing has to go absolutely perfectly
for 14,
to
yep.
fit what you wanted to fit into 14 seconds
Correct.
To fit into 14 seconds. Okay.
Correct. So I thought Dallas making that decision with the 14 seconds on the clock, it wasn't worth it. You were already in Hail Mary range. I would have preferred the two Hail Mary attempts. But Owen Daniels goes right down to the ground, gives himself up, declares himself down. That never happened with Dak. Dak went and went 3, 4, 5 yards further than really
yes.
you want, and it's not worth the 1.5 or 2 second difference. So that's step number one. Step number two is the official has to touch the football. And there's multiple examples. Like Larry Fitzgerald is the guy who's notorious for getting the ball outside the numbers and running it in to where the ball is to get spotted. There's multiple examples of Larry running the ball to the center turning and handing it to the official because everybody on the offense is aware. And that's what it didn't look like with Dallas.
Correct.
No one was aware that, oh my goodness, the official has to spot the ball, fellas, not ourselves. That's why I say, yes, this has got to fall on the people that are teaching it. The third thing is, dude, you got to go with your hair on fire. We are dying if we don't get this urgency to get lined up and get an illegal formation. And the legal formation is simple. When you, again, teach this, everybody, if you're the outside receiver, you're on the football. I don't care who you are. I don't care where you were last play. You're on the football. Everybody else, receiver, tight end, and running back wise, you're off the football. So if you watch the play happen, Noah Brown and Dalton Schultz are walking around like it's a stroll in the park. Dude, there's 4 seconds on the clock, fellas. And so again, I don't care how many times, did you practice that urgency? Like when you practiced it at the Star on Friday, did you practice with that urgency? Because if you did, then that's on the coaches. And then the last part is, you always practice things until you can't get them wrong, not until you get them right. And you make sure that your quarterback knows, hey, if we do this and it doesn't go the way we're planning, we got to have a get out of jail free card. And we called it 911. If you get to 3 seconds on the clock and we're not ready to take the snap, you're screaming 911, 911. That is erasing the spike. We're going to Hail Mary. We are not spiking the football, guys. Everyone get into your urgent legal formation. Now we're in Hail Mary mode. We're not. So that's why I say, like, yes, do I want Dak to slide earlier?
Yes.
But it comes down to me watching the process of Dallas operating going, they weren't ready for the multiple situations or scenarios that could have happened.
And that's why I say, Dan, I don't disagree that there is responsibility with coaching.
Right.
And I've also, you know, I'm spoiled. You know, I spent a bunch of seasons with number 12 up in New England. And I saw him override coaching decisions. I have been with other quarterbacks that have, you know, overrode coaching decisions and things, whether it's the decision, but just had the moment of sliding. It's called the slider play, right? Whether it's good,
sure.
Whether it's a pass to Owen Daniel or whether it's the quarterback, the slider, you got to know when to slide. Right. You're taught that, you know that, or even if you're not taught that, if you're that level caliber quarterback, you just need to know when to do it as well. And that's why
right.
I say there's shared responsibility. I don't disagree with all the other things you're saying as well, Dan.
Yeah.
There's clearly a gap in what people were doing, and it just makes you ask the next question without accusing, just saying, okay, what were they taught? What weren't they taught? That's the mm-hmm. part that I want mm-hmm. to see. Not that I want to, you know, want this whole thing exposed, but gosh, you know, I look at the course of this game though, you know, going into this game, they were the most penalized team in the National Football League, the Cowboys.
Yep, it rang true.
And I did a little tweet before the game that they can't be that team. Well, they were that team. But here's part of what bothers me about the offense too. They led the NFL in offensive pre-snap penalties.
Mm-hmm.
Led the NFL. That's telling me, and when we know what pre-snap penalties are, people say, it's concentration because of the false start. Well, sometimes those false starts, it's a matter of players not being lined up. Another pre-snap penalty is a false, you know, not just a false start, but it's a delay of game penalty. To me, you know, we're looking at all these wonderful things about the coaching of the offense of the Dallas Cowboys. But when I see a team that's leading the National Football League in pre-snap penalties on offense, there's something wrong. Of the 14 penalties that the Cowboys had that game, I believe it was an NFL record, franchise record and NFL record, I believe tied, 6 were pre-snap penalties. Now, a couple on defense because Randy Gregory was in the neutral zone and Micah Parsons was in the neutral zone, but six were pre-snap penalties. That's a big picture thing to me.
Scott, I'll take it to the next level. Eight of them either gave San Francisco a first down or took a first down away from themselves. Eight. You know, that's huge. I don't care if it's week three or, you know, the divisional wild card weekend type of thing. So that's an issue that Dallas has got to figure out. Are they okay living with that right now in with the reality of their contract or their football team? I'll talk about Dak a little bit in this game as well. I thought when it just strictly comes to seeing the field well, worst game I've seen from him in a couple years. Worst game I've seen from him in a couple years. Two plays that stand out to me, both happen in almost succession of themselves in the third quarter. You guys remember the second 28 interception by Williams, right? The nickel defender. Mm-hmm. You know, the Cowboys are in their trip set 3-by-1, and it's second and 28, and they're calling something to get 12 yards, and let's see if we can have a chance at third down type of thing. And the 49ers run cover four, which is the secondary players have that. They cut the field into quarters, and they got deep quarters. But what happens is when you get a trips formation in that situation, the safety that's backside to that single receiver side, he can do something called four kick or four push, meaning he will, when the ball gets snapped, go and kind of kick or push towards the way of the trips to kind of elevate numbers. And it really singles up the backside corner almost in man one-to-one. CeeDee Lamb runs a 15-yard stop route, and he's wide open. And Dak never looks that way. I mean, you're taught as a quarterback in that play design, when you got 15-yard pivots on the outside and 10-yard hook routes on the inside and trips, find that boundary safety if you get a too high shell. And if he goes back to cover two, we're working inside. And then if he rotates a little bit towards the field, you should be working backside to your single receiver. He doesn't. Well, then he works frontside. That's fine. You always work inside out on that play. And you work away from squeeze. The tight end gets squeezed by the linebacker. Okay, we work away from squeeze. You go to the outside guy, that slot receiver. He's getting squeezed by Williams. The number one receiver running a 15-yard pivot route is wide open. And Dak just forces the ball to the nickel, even though he's squeezing the slot receiver, and it ends up being an interception. That's one play, and I could give you five or six that he just didn't see the field well when it came to post-snap coverage.
And can I circle this all the way back as well to the officials and how this also plays into whether Mike McCarthy and that coaching staff has these guys ready to play? And it ties into what Scott talked about, pre-snap penalties. It was amazing how many people consider themselves football experts didn't know that at the end of the game on the last play, the officials did nothing wrong.
Right.
They handled that situation exactly the way that the officials are supposed to handle that situation. You can't spot the ball yourself. You can't hand the ball to your center and have the center determine the line of scrimmage and have the center then say, the ball is now ready for play, I'm ready, and snap it. You have to your point, Dan, find the umpire, give him the ball, he sets it. Back to another play that people were up in arms about. They fake the punt and then get the delay of game penalty to start the fourth quarter after the faked punt.
Right.
And everybody blamed it on the officials. The umpire stood over the ball until there was 2 seconds on the play clock. Well, that's because your team didn't substitute until there was like 18 seconds on the play clock. Not only did they not substitute, they substituted their entire offense. Like, it's one thing if you're at the line of scrimmage with 18 on the play clock and you sub a wide receiver for a tight end, right? Like, it's not in the rule book that there is a specific amount of time that the official has to give the defense to substitute. The verbiage, as far as I know, is a reasonable amount of time to substitute. So if you make like a one player for one player exchange with 18 on the play clock, then that's fine. Then maybe the defense can make a one player for one player exchange, and they've got enough time to substitute. But if you run your entire offense out on the field with 18 seconds on the play clock, the officials are going to stand over the ball, because now if I'm on the other sideline, I have to look at everything that you have just run on the field. How many tight ends are out there? How many wide receivers are out there? How many running backs are out there? Now I have to correspondingly substitute with my entire defense potentially. And the official is taught to stand over the football and give the defense the right to substitute. to me, if you're running your whole offense out there, fire drill-wise, with like 18 seconds on the play clock, and by the way, if you go back, you'll realize they even midway through the play clock reset it. I'm not even sure why. It went from 40 down to 18 or 17 or something. The Cowboys hadn't substituted, and then they took it from 17 back up to 25, started running it again, and it still took them 6 or 7 right. seconds to substitute. To me, that's a microcosm of the way that they played the last play of the game and the fact that they are unprepared for that spot and take a delay of game penalty that is 100% on them, Bobby, and 0% on the officials, that to me shows they're just not being coached these situations correctly.
Well, and I know we got to cut short right now, but to wrap up your thought of this is not a singular situation. Week two against the Chargers, they can't find the clocks. And they don't know when to use their timeouts. Week 3 against the Eagles before halftime, they're up 20-7, a buck 50 on the clock. They allow Philadelphia to wear the clock out, not using timeouts. Week 6 against New England, they call a timeout and kick a field goal with 24 seconds on the clock rather than allowing it to run all the way down. New England gets the ball back. Week 15 against the Giants, end of the first half, he completes the ball to Dalton Schultz, and they don't use the timeout because they don't. He says, well, we don't want to take a shot. We're in the O zone. Week 17 against the Cardinals, he calls a timeout, and they don't have the ability to challenge a potential fumble by Chase Edmonds. I mean, this is a habitual behavior or theme that the management of that stuff, and I'm not pretending it's easy, is not done well.
Yep, and it definitely has consequences right down to the last game of the season. That obviously ends the Cowboys' season. We haven't even gotten to Bucks-Eagles yet, by the way. That was exactly, the scoreboard told the story of that game, and we're going to talk a lot about the Bucks when we get to our matchups on Thursday. But when we come back, we're going to talk about the Monday night playoff game. And we're also going to touch on the other last game of the weekend, what we saw from the Chiefs, has everything come together for them, and Matthew Stafford gets his first playoff win. Both of those are topics we discuss when we get back on Tape Heads. We are back on this wild card wrap-up edition of Tape Heads. Bob Wischusen, Dan Orlovsky, Scott Pioli. All right, guys, got a couple of more games we haven't touched on. Quickly, there's not probably much to say about Chiefs-Steelers. I mean, we'll start with that one. To me, that's really just one team being a whole lot better than the other team. And, you know, the Steelers were a nice story with Ben Roethlisberger's career wrapping up with an appearance in the postseason. But do you take a lot out of a win for the Chiefs over the Steelers and the fact that, you know, Patrick Mahomes continues to keep this offense rolling and a lot of different weapons seem to be involved that maybe weren't involved a month or two ago, right? I mean, this doesn't now seem to have to be the Tyreek Hill, Travis Kelce show all the time. Some other guys are making plays for him.
I don't take much out of the game. No, Pittsburgh's, they're not a good football team.
Yeah.
But that's what you're supposed to do. I mean, here's the truth, Bobby, in this game. It's 6 minutes to go in the second quarter, and it's nothing-nothing. You know, it became a barrage. I get that, but it was a nothing-nothing football game. I don't think, you know, Kansas City was playing incredibly well. And there's that theme, you know, that I'm not in love with when it comes to Kansas City. I will say this. Some of the stuff that I do like seeing from them, in relation to the quarterback, mechanically in a much better place. I still think he's a little deep in his drops, but mechanically in a much better place. I think Tyreek is back to getting really good feel versus zone. But my favorite part of this game, and it's been a trending thing, is I like the fact that they're playing in some 12 personnel, some of their one back, two tight end stuff, and they're putting a guy like Noah Gray on the football field. I just think it helps their baseline balance football-wise. You know, the fact that they can put two tight ends in the field, and yeah, they can run the football a little bit. They can still get into their RPO game a little bit. They can get into a little bit of their 12 personnel play action game, some stuff. You can still be wildly creative and formationally and motion kind of really creative in those personnel groupings. I kind of like that out of Kansas City. I think they're going to need it this weekend against Buffalo. So I do like the fact that they're doing a little bit more just baseline stuff to help them.
Yeah, I probably liked it a little bit more, Dan, but for this reason. I don't disagree that the level of competition that day, you know, was not very good. But the Steelers are still an NFL football team that made the playoffs and can do some things good. To me, what I got out of that was we watched them improve. You're 100% right that they struggled at the beginning. I was surprised, quite honestly, that the game started the way it did. They've been a weird team this year in that sense, the Chiefs. However, they got rolling. And I think what that does for them is it reminds them of how good they can be. It gives them confidence, confidence that they need when they're going up against a team like Buffalo. But to me, I liked a little bit more just because they had another opportunity to see what they can do when they're at their best. What they better learn from this game is they can't do against Buffalo what they did this last week against Pittsburgh, and that's get a slow start. Because if they get a slow start, we know how good the opponent's going to be and put points on them in right.
Yeah.
You know, let's shift maybe to the Monday night game real quick because, look, Matthew Stafford, great story. And getting his first playoff win, fantastic. We have been talking about the impact of the DeAndre Hopkins injury on the offense for the Cardinals for months now, right? I mean, it's been like weeks on this show. We've said they're never going to be the same without him. But that, to me, last night was about a team like Team A just physically dominating Team B in every possible way.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, and that, I don't know how much that has to do with DeAndre Hopkins not being there for Kyler Murray, but that was the Rams can block the Cardinals and the Cardinals can't block the Rams. And it was both sides of the football. That was, I thought, a physical beatdown at the line of scrimmage as much as any other element to that game, skill position players being there or not.
Well, I thought a starting point too for me, Bob, was one coach did everything in his power to make sure that they didn't play handcuffed and one coach did. I thought Sean McVay's commitment to running the rock on the outside zone and commitment to making sure Arizona doesn't do this well, so we're going to attack it. And hey, we're not great in the drop back protection game. I'm not going to live in that. And then Cliff, vice versa, there was just, from the first play of the game, it was this desire to threaten the secondary of the Rams because of some of the safety issues and push the ball downfield. And I'm sitting there going, listen, Hoss, dude, you can't block 99 and 40 and 54. You can't. This ball should be playing sideline to sideline. Get it out as quick as possible. Make these cats run. And it's not schematically, the Rams do not allow you to push the ball downfield defensively. They are just not schematically built that way. And I just watched them try to do it over and over again, and it just become this kind of fall off or snowball effect. And so it definitely line of scrimmage was a big deal. I thought Matthew was really good with his progressions. I thought Cam Akers brought vision.
Absolutely.
Vision and physicality to their run game. And I think that was very impressive.
You know, you say that they were able to, that Sean decided he was going to stay with the run game. He did because he could. And Cam Akers, I'll tell you what, that was one of the most impressive performances of the season to me. And I say that not because of the numbers, but you look at what he's overcome and in such a short time, what he did and the way that he played last night and the dimension it gave that offense and the confidence it gave the offense, it made a big difference. And, you know, I think the other thing that was revealed yesterday or last night was Kyler Murray. And I've always been, I haven't been able to sign up for Kyler Murray yet. I really haven't. And I'll tell you why. Some of the short passes, he runs around, he makes plays, he extends plays, and sometimes he nails it when he gets it, he can throw it up. But there were some very simple throws last night, checkdowns, screens. He can't make some of the simple throws, some of the basic throws that when he's not necessarily under duress, he just, and then that play, the pick six, I can't get past that, man.
Even the best of us make some boneheaded plays backed up on our own ends and under pressure.
I don't want to believe it, Dan. You know? Like, as Brady said, even Brady Crocker burns the brownies every once in a while, right? We talked about that earlier in the year. No, but it wasn't just one play, Dan.
You're right.
It wasn't just one play. And that play was fascinating to me because everyone talked about, you know, Kyler Murray. But what I love was what Raheem did on that. We going into the game, I had said this before the game, that Aaron Donald was going to be a difference maker, and he was in their head and going to be in their heads.
Yes.
And
God,
to me, please go back, folks, and watch this play. What they did, Aaron Donald's line, they have a four, it's a 3.5 man front because really the one defensive end is split out, but Aaron Donald is to the offense's right.
Yep.
And at the snap of the ball, they immediately slide the protection. They've got four people trying to block two.
Kyler checked it pre-snap to slide to him. Yep.
Yes. And what happens is Aaron Donald, again, I don't know if he was dropping into coverage like a zone blitz or if he was dropping back in the middle to be a spy, right? Because they had two players actually spying and two linemen. And then they brought Reader and Chase Edmonds not only had to try to pick up Reader, you know, it's that linebacker running back, usually a mismatch. He can only do for so long. But what happened, because of the slide protection went so wide to Aaron Donald, who ended up not being there, there was this gap and amount of space where, you know, when you're watching practice in training camp and you've got the one-on-one blitz pickup drills and it's unrealistic because the backs are trying to pick up a blitzer in this wide open space. Because the protection slid the way that it did and the amount that it did, there was this enormous space that, again, Chase Edmonds just couldn't make the play, couldn't make the block, and sure enough, it got him.
I love that you brought up that point, man. I mean, because that play, we were doing the mega cast when it happened, and I remember watching Kyler go up to the line of scrimmage and check, and I was like, okay, he's pushing everything to 99. And then Marcus Spears immediately goes, watch for the screen. And Reader triggers, Aaron Donald falls back. And I'm like, holy smokes, they dropped there in coverage. They got exactly what they wanted. And Kyler obviously makes a horrific decision. But that's one of those where I kind of tip my hat to the defense, just an impressive design.
Call and execution.
Yeah.
And this weekend, that defense is going to be trying to fool Tom Brady. So a slightly different challenge in terms of the mental acuity of the quarterback that you're going to be trying to fool, because wild card weekend is now in the books. We now move on to the divisional round. And we're going to talk about that on Thursday. Please get in touch with us on social media. We hope you have a terrific week. We hope you join us again on Thursday when we break down the divisional games coming up this weekend. Join us Thursday on Tapeheads.